Have you noticed that ambition and hustle doesn't exactly turn anyone on anymore? And we used to worship that stuff, right? The grind was our religion. And people would brag about sleeping only 3 hours a night like it was a war medal or something. And they'd post their 4 a.m. productivity screenshots like they were climbing Everest in a spreadsheet. And now everyone just looks like they need a very long nap and the permission to quit permanently. So it appears there's a seismic shift underway where people are transitioning from rise and grind to, I can't remember why I got out of bed, but here I am, I guess. Now, I'm not saying we've given up entirely, of course not. But I am saying there's something almost spiritual about how we've, collectively realized that wanting less might be the only rebellion left that doesn't require a podcast about it. So the Japanese have a term for this, Te Yukobo Shakai, the low desire society. And Kenichi Omai wrote about this, where he described it as a culture where people just stopped wanting. They're not chasing the dream anymore because they looked at the dream in horror after realizing it was a coffin disguised as a penthouse. So instead, they're trading ambition for equilibrium. And they're swapping that corner office for not having a panic attack in the parking lot. Now, if that sounds kind of beautiful to you, you're right. But if it also sounds like the opening act of societal collapse, well, you're also right. And therein lies the paradox. A society that stops wanting things might actually find peace, but it also might stop functioning. And civilization, whether we like it or not, runs on desire. That's the engine. Desire builds cities, populations, it invents Wi-Fi. You know, it makes people start podcasts at 2 a.m. that nobody asked for. Desire is why we don't all just sit in a dark room, staring at a candle, thinking, yeah, this is fine. Though, lately, a lot of people are sitting in the dark, staring at a candle, thinking, you know what? This is fine. And it's spreading because now you see it everywhere, especially with younger people. This quiet revolt against hustle and consumerism, the whole performance. They don't want the big house and the fancy car anymore. What they want is 8 hours of sleep. And they don't want a six-figure salary if it's going to come with a side of cosmic dread and a boss named Lumberg who says, circle back unironically. And I completely get it. I really do. They're tired. You know, we've all seen the man behind the curtain, and it turns out he's just some guy in a hoodie trying to sell us a kilo of hopium. But I think there's something maybe somewhat fragile in this new piece. Because the same impulse that makes you say, I don't need more, can very easily become, why bother at all? Why do anything? And that line, the one between enlightenment and apathy, it's probably thinner than you might think. You can choose less because you're full, or because you've basically given up. But at this point, most of us don't actually know which one we even are. So this is the age of quietly quitting. You know, this is a term we've heard often at this point. It's clocking in, doing exactly what's required, and then clocking out. No extras, no hustle, no pretending the job is your identity. Now, at first glance, it looks something like progress, like we're finally evolving past the hamster wheel. But if you look a little closer, you start to see we're not actually choosing peace. We're retreating into it. We've hit this global burnout where even ambition feels embarrassing, where trying too hard is bad manners, and the most radical thing you can say at a party is, yeah, I'm content. And it's right there in the data. Declining birth rates, fewer marriages, less work, less ownership, less consumption, and on and on. And this isn't out of laziness. It's out of disinterest and probably exhaustion. Because frankly, the juice just isn't worth the squeeze anymore. And honestly, why the hell would it be? We were all told to climb the ladder, but the ladder's missing half its rungs, and it ends at a job that doesn't even exist anymore because the building got turned into a WeWork. So naturally, people are opting out. And good for them, honestly. At least it's authentic. At least they're saying what most of us have been secretly thinking. I don't need to conquer the world. I just want to stop feeling like I'm losing all the damn time. That's the core of the low desire society. It's not really about hating ambition. It's about realizing that ambition just doesn't love you back. And it's about developing enough self-awareness and self-respect to just say no. And that's where I think it gets a little interesting and a little dangerous, because if a society runs on human desire and we all start pressing the brakes, what happens to everything, you know, built on the assumption that we just keep wanting more? Here's the inconvenient truth. Most of our progress came from people who weren't okay with being okay. Every skyscraper, every invention, It all came from restless lunatics who looked at a reasonably functional world and basically said, yeah, but what if it was faster and it gave me a dopamine hit? So we built an entire civilization on that restless energy. And we told ourselves that wanting more was what made us human. And the second you stop wanting, you stopped mattering. So in a sense, you know, you became subhuman. But lately, when lately I think we're rethinking this. Because what happens when you finally reach the top of the ladder and you realize it's just leaning against a giant billboard that says, drink Pepsi or whatever? That's where the philosophers come in. You know, some of the old ones saw all of this coming. Schopenhauer, for instance, the original sad boy of philosophy is what I call him. Basically, he said, life is this endless loop of wanting things, sometimes getting them, then realizing that they didn't help, and then wanting new things. Now, he thought the only real peace comes from reducing desire, not fulfilling it, reducing it. So he called desire the root of suffering, which, if you've ever dropped $400 on something you didn't need and felt hollow 2 days later, you know exactly what he was talking about. And that's the rub. Desire creates suffering, but suffering also gives life a sense of meaning. So in a sense, you're kind of screwed either way. But Buddhism takes a softer angle with this concept. It doesn't say don't want. It just says want carefully and want wisely. And then be ready to just let it all go. Don't get attached. So the problem isn't actually really desire. It's attachment. Alan Watts put this perfectly when he said, you can't enjoy the dance if you're clinging to the floor. But the problem here is that modern life taught us to cling to everything. All our stuff, our image, other people, our productivity metrics, and on and on. We're all white-knuckling this shaky floor, going, well, if I just hold on a little tighter, maybe I won't fail. And then we wonder why everyone's having a collective breakdown. The thing is, the modern low desire movement isn't born from enlightenment. It's born from exhaustion. And people aren't renouncing desire because they've transcended it. They're renouncing it because, well, it stopped paying off. So it's not, I've reached nirvana. It's more like, I'm just too damn tired for any more disappointment. And honestly, fair enough. Because what does more even mean anymore when living on a planet where billionaires are trying to colonize Mars, and the rest of us are just trying to remember our Netflix password. At this point, it's becoming very clear that our desires have outgrown our means and our minds, and even the world itself. So it should really come as no surprise that people are quietly pulling the plug. They're realizing that maybe the best thing you can do for yourself and for the planet is just to stop chasing every shiny object and just sit the hell down. Take a breather. There's nothing glamorous or Instagrammable about it, but it's probably the most revolutionary act we have left. And then there's the issue of antinatalism. David Benatar argues that bringing a new person into the world is inherently unethical because existence guarantees suffering. He's the guy who shows up to the baby shower with a pamphlet titled, "Have You Considered Not?" Now, of course, most people are going to find that a little extreme. Nonetheless, it seems that this is resonating with a growing number of mostly younger people who they don't see the future as a promise. They see it as a threat. I mean, when the cost of living is practically impossible, the planet's on fire, and your job could be replaced by AI, and, you know, it's not shocking that people are questioning whether adding more humans to this mess makes any sense. And then there's minimalism, which in theory is beautiful and sensible, and I appreciate it myself. But it seems like these days in practice, it's been hijacked by the same consumer culture it was supposed to reject. Which means we've turned owning less into a lifestyle brand. So now you can buy a $300 minimalist lamp to help you stop wanting things. And that's the irony of modern corporate capitalism. It can monetize even your escape attempts. It's that insidious. You try to simplify, and then the next thing you know, you're in a YouTube rabbit hole about the top 10 minimalist water bottles of the year. I mean, we can't even want less about or without wanting the best way to want less. So, yeah, we're trapped in this weird paradox. We've got a society that runs on desire, that's self-destructing from too much wanting, and the only cure seems to be not wanting at all. But a society with no desire isn't really a civilization anymore. It's more like hospice. And it's a very delicate balance. You can't build cathedrals on apathy, but you can't build peace on endless craving either. So what to do. You know, I think about Hirayama a lot lately. Who the hell's Hirayama? All right, well, he's the main character from Perfect Days, a movie by Wim Wenders that should have been boring, but I find somehow far from it. Now, there might be a few minor spoilers ahead, just fair warning. Though I'd argue that this movie doesn't really have spoilers because it's more about awareness and presence than plot. So, Hirayama is a toilet cleaner in Tokyo. He lives alone. He listens to old cassette tapes. He reads paperbacks, takes photographs of trees, and that's pretty much it. No dramatic plot, no explosions. Just a man cleaning toilets and existing with quiet dignity. And yet, it's really a hypnotic film. It's got a deeper message. Because Hirayama does something almost nobody in modern society figures out how to do. He's content, regardless of what his situation may look like. So he wakes up at the same time every morning. He folds his uniform with ritual precision, goes to work, eats lunch in a park under a tree. And somehow, by the time this movie ends, you realize he's probably, arguably, the happiest man alive. And it's obviously not because he has everything. It's because at some point in his life, he stopped believing he needed to. And it's interesting because we watch this guy doing what in capitalist terms would be considered one of the lowest status jobs imaginable. And yet he radiates something that CEOs spend millions of dollars trying to simulate. Peace. It's kind of like watching enlightenment disguised as janitorial work. And I think that's what makes this film so subversive, because it forces you to ask, what if the meaning of life isn't somewhere out there, but instead it's in the 5 square feet of space directly in front of you? What if you don't need to go find yourself? Because ultimately there is no separate self, and you're content cleaning a toilet really, really well. Now, I know this sounds crazy to most of us. So in the old world, you know, before social media and smartphones and all that, people like Hirayama were pretty much invisible. The discreet working class, you know, the people who didn't demand to be noticed. They didn't care about being noticed. They weren't influencers with personal brands. They were just human. But in a low desire society, he becomes something of a hero, because his life represents what we've lost: presence and rhythm. And he doesn't talk about mindfulness, he just lives it. He doesn't post about minimalism because he basically embodies it. And watching him, you realize that what passes for success these days is often just a very expensive way of running away from yourself. And maybe the real success is just learning to enjoy simple acts like washing your hands. And not because it's spiritual, but because it's Tuesday and you're alive and your hands are dirty. So I think what makes Hirayama powerful isn't that he's special. On the contrary, it's that he's ordinary and he's perfectly okay with this. He's not numbed by apathy. He's simply alive in the tiniest of details. The light through the window, and the way he just sits and stares at a tree. There's this moment near the end of the film where he's sitting in his car and he's listening to music. And for about 30 seconds, he smiles and he cries at the same time. There's no explanation, there's no dialogue. It's just a moment of pure, almost unbearable beauty of just being a human being here and now, and just for a little while. And that's what the low desire life can look like when it's chosen, not when it's surrendered to. It's not really apathy, it's gratitude disguised as stillness. And I think that's what scares people about this new movement. It's not laziness. This is what it is. It's the quiet realization that peace might be the last thing worth chasing. And this terrifies the systems built to keep us chasing everything else all the time. It terrifies them. Do you ever notice how every app now feels like a slot machine that occasionally gives you emotional validation instead of money? There's, I don't know, a little red bubble, a heart, maybe a new follower. And we're living inside a Vegas casino run by behavioral psychologists, where, of course, the house always wins. Because dopamine isn't happiness, it's the chemical of anticipation. It's the thrill of maybe. And it's why we keep checking and refreshing, scrolling, like rats hitting a button that used to dispense cocaine and now just dispenses the possibility of it. And we keep wondering why we're all anxious all the time. Now, our nervous systems were built for forests, not firing squads of stimuli. The average person at this point in time consumes more information in a week than someone in the 1800s did in their entire lifetime. Think about that. Now, that probably sounds impressive until you figure out that most of what we're doing is arguing on the internet about things that nobody really understands. And it's pretty clear in these batshit crazy times that we're just drowning in all this. this meaningless data and starving for meaning. And it's, you know, it's not just the phones. It's also our jobs, which have become like psychological endurance tests. I mean, half the workforce sits in front of screens pretending to collaborate on platforms designed to look productive while preventing anyone from doing actual work. So we've managed to gamify our own attention spans into extinction. Have you noticed how adults talk about burnout like it's a rare condition or something? Oh, I had burnout last year. No, you didn't. You live in burnout. That's just your baseline now. It's like calling the ocean a little damp this week. I mean, look at it this way. We're becoming these lab rats on treadmills that go nowhere. And then we congratulate each other for how fast we're running. And we, you know, we even brag about this now. I'm so busy. I barely sleep. You know, these aren't accomplishments. These are symptoms. Or even better, they're straight up medical conditions. It's like bragging you've been coughing for 8 months straight. But that's modern corporate capitalism. Take the pathology, sell it as a personality, make burnout somehow aspirational, make exhaustion a virtue. And I'm out here thinking, make it make sense. And when you finally crash, when your body finally gives out, the system looks down at you and says, well, you should have practiced more self-care. Self-care. As if lighting a candle and taking a bath is going to fix a culture that functions like a stress test. That's kind of like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound and saying, well, just try journaling about it. But we've basically created a world where the goal is no longer to live. It's to cope. And somehow manage the chaos instead of questioning why it's there in the first place. And we've traded meaning for management. And we've turned therapy into some kind of performance. Not to mention, we're using apps for meditation now. And then we wonder why everyone feels spiritually bankrupt. We're told to find balance in a system that profits from keeping us permanently off balance. It's like trying to meditate while someone keeps poking you in the ribs and then charging you for the privilege. And you start to realize this isn't just a tech issue or even a capitalism issue. It's a human issue because we built this whole experiment ourselves. We designed the maze and then forgot how to get the hell out of it. But I don't think the answer is necessarily smashing the machines or going off to live in the woods, because that too has been romanticized. The you know, the digital detox, the off-grid fantasy. You go out into nature to escape the algorithm, and then you spend the whole time hiking, filming it for your followers. So, you know, the real rebellion isn't withdrawal, it's awareness. It's learning to see the experiment for what it really is. And you learn when you're being nudged and baited and sold an emotion instead of feeling one. And you know, once you start noticing it, it loses its power. That's the trick. The rats who figured out that they're in the maze are the ones that stop running. If you ever watch those old psychology experiments where they drop a rat in a maze and they make it run through dead ends to find cheese, you notice that they never show what happens when the rat stops caring about the cheese. That's kind of what waking up feels like now. You stop chasing the rewards you were trained to want, and you start asking, wait, what the hell am I even doing here? That's usually when the experiment loses control, because you've stopped playing. You've opted out, at least mentally. The thing about modern life isn't that it's meaningless. It's that it's manufactured meaning. It's artificially flavored purpose. Diet existence. It looks like life, but there's no nutrition to it. And we've been sold happiness that it lives somewhere at the end of a graph, you know, higher income, bigger house, more likes, more money, etc. But every rat that's chased that cheese realizes the maze just keeps extending. Because they keep moving the walls every time you get close. And at some point, you have to stop running and take a breather and ask yourself, maybe I don't want to win a game designed to make me feel like I'm always losing. And I think that's what real sanity looks like right now. Not pretending you're thriving in some insane environment, just quietly deciding you don't want to play anymore. Now, you'll do what you need to survive, of course. Pay the bills, show up. But you just stop selling your soul for dopamine pellets. This isn't rebellion with the fireworks. It's rebellion with stillness. Just sitting there in your own peace and quiet while the world screams for attention and not responding. That's what peace looks like now. Not calm music and candles, just not reacting and not taking the bait. Because the moment you stop reacting, you stop being predictable. You can slow down. You can actually choose to respond rather than react. And that's what freaks the system out. You're supposed to be predictable. You were programmed to scroll, click, consume, repeat. That's the experiment. But when you start noticing, when you start laughing at the manipulation instead of falling for it, you become the outlier. The lab rat that figured out the exit door has been open the whole time. Now, awareness isn't some perfect cure. You're still going to get tired. You'll get lonely. And, you know, you'll still get sucked into the vortex and realize you just lost 3 hours watching videos of people cleaning their kitchens or whatever. It's all right. We all relapse. You know, it's important to note here that the point isn't perfection. It's never perfection. It's consciousness. It's noticing when you've fallen asleep and when you've been hypnotized by the noise. And when that happens, you pause and you say, oh, right, I'm in the maze again. And then you step off the wheel. And, you know, it takes practice. I think that's the muscle worth building now. Forget productivity and all the toxic positivity that comes with it. Build awareness. Work on emotional intelligence and self-awareness. Because, you know, once you have that, you can't fully go back. You know, you still have bad days, don't get me wrong, but you'll never again make the mistake that the maze is, you know, is the world or for the world. So what do we do with all this? I mean, how do you live a sane life inside an insane experiment? Well, I think you simplify. Not in the performative, curated way. You simplify your mind. It all starts within, on the inside. You gradually remove unnecessary noise, unnecessary goals, versions of yourself built to impress some imaginary audience, and you choose slowness where everything is demanding speed. You choose boredom and silence in a world that's addicted to noise and where everything begs for constant stimulation. Now, this isn't about quitting technology. It's about no longer being trained and manipulated by it. No longer being a stimulus waiting for a reaction. You'll learn to use the tools without letting them use you. It's like taking your mind back from the lab techs. And maybe that's the real point here. We're not lab rats anymore. We're former lab rats telling other rats that there's something more beyond the limits of the maze. Because once you see how artificial it all is, the algorithms, all the fake rewards, the endless hustle, the misguided outrage, the endless performance of self, you realize there's something much quieter and underneath it all, much older. real connection, real thought, and stillness. The kind that doesn't fit neatly into a feed. And I think when you find that, even just for a moment, you start to remember what being human actually feels like. The digital version starts to dissipate. And you begin to remember the real and messy and inconvenient, unoptimized kind. So maybe the goal isn't to win the experiment or destroy it or even necessarily to escape it. Maybe it's just to become aware enough to laugh at it and stop giving it power. And to see the absurdity of it all, but nonetheless, to keep your soul intact. Because at the end of the day, the only sane reaction to an insane world is a refusal. And a dark sense of humor doesn't hurt either, in my opinion. And I think that's the one thing the experiment can't measure, because it's not data, it's defiance. So yeah, you know, we might be lab rats, but at least we're learning to become self-aware ones. And well, you got to start somewhere. All right. I think that's all I have today. As always, thanks for listening.